burden to place on a child. It's also not completely accurate. Earl was already neglecting his wife by that point. If anything, Tiger and his early proficiency in golf are what held his parents together. On the other hand, Earl deserves credit for recognizing so early on that his son possessed rare natural talents and abilities. As a father, he intended to do everything in his power to harness and develop those talents. Since 1966, the Navy golf course, Seal Beach, has been serving military families by directing 100% of its profits to support morale, welfare, and recreation programs for active duty sailors and their families. The then military-only facility featured a championship 18-hole destroyer course measuring 6,780 yards, as well as a shorter 9-hole cruiser course that featured 4 par 4s and 5 par 3s. The course was less than 2 miles away, a 5-minute drive from the Woods' home. As retired military, Earl had playing privileges there and was a constant presence on the course. Over time, he became one of the very best players at the club. Caltita never went there until Tiger was able to come along. When he was 18 months old, she started bringing him to the driving range to hit balls. Afterwards, she would put him back in his stroller and he'd doze off. Some days, Caltita would telephone Earl at work and hand the phone to Tiger. "Daddy, can I play golf with you today?" he would ask. Earl loved it, and he never told his son no. It was Caltita's job to get Tiger to the course, beginning when Tiger was 2 years old. Earl made sure he spent 2 hours per day hitting golf balls. At an age when most toddlers were developing motor skills and feeling different textures by doing things like playing in sandboxes, Tiger was on a golf course with his father, developing the habit of practice, practice, practice. Then one evening in 1978, Earl Woods made a decision that would alter the course of his young son's life. He placed a call to television station KNXT, then the CBS affiliate in Los Angeles, and asked for Jim Hill, the 32-year-old sports anchor. "My son is 2 years old," Earl began, "and I'm telling you right now that he's going to be the next big thing in golf. He's going to revolutionize everything, including race relations." It was a blunt way to open a call with a complete stranger. Deeply skeptical, Hill wasn't sure how to respond. "What makes you say that?" he replied. To Earl's credit, he knew how to pitch his son to the media, and he always did his homework. Hill had spent 7 years as a defensive back in the NFL and loved to play golf. More important, he was an African-American who cared deeply about minority youth and had been very involved in local outreach through the Los Angeles Urban League and the Los Angeles Department of Parks and Recreation. He was well aware that golf courses throughout the country had traditionally shut blacks out. Earl insisted that his son would one day open the game up to kids of color around the nation. The next morning, Hill and a camera crew pulled into the parking lot at the Navy course. Earl, in a golf shirt and cap, smiled warmly and extended his hand. "Where's Tiger?" Hill said. "Come on," Earl said, leading him to the driving range. As they approached, Hill recognized one of the sweetest sounds in sports. A golf club making square contact with a golf ball. He was shocked when he saw who was responsible for that sound. "I see this little tiger hitting golf balls straight," Hill recalled. "I mean straight. Not kinda straight, straight." He was only a couple of feet tall, yet he was hitting it 50 yards, and he was hitting the ball flush every time. Hill was no longer skeptical. "Hi, Tiger. How are you?" Hill said. Silent, Tiger stared up at him. "Can I play golf with you?" Hill asked. Tiger nodded his head. Hill sliced his first drive. He hooked his second one. "I'm not that good, am I?" he said, smiling. "No," Tiger said, straight-faced. Hill was smitten. This 2-year-old possessed a swing that looked destined for the PGA Tour, yet the boy had an innocence that matched his size. The trip to Long Beach had definitely been worth it. After the camera crew got footage of Tiger driving and putting, Earl took them to the clubhouse. "Tiger," Hill said gently, "I need you to do an interview with me." Earl put his son on his lap and had him face Hill and the camera. Tiger, Hill asked. What is it about golf that you like so much? Tiger sighed, tilted his head to one side, and said nothing. Hill tried the question another way. Once again, Tiger said nothing. No matter what Hill tried, Tiger wasn't talking. Finally, after a long pause and some encouragement from Earl to Tiger, Hill leaned forward. Tiger, he said, grinning, my career is in your hands. I need you to tell me what it is about golf you like so much. Tiger slid from Earl's lap and sighed. I gotta go poo-poo. Hill cracked up. So did the camera crew. Hill's segment on Tiger aired in Los Angeles and became one of the most memorable pieces of television news in his 40-plus years of broadcast journalism. The footage of a 2-year-old swinging a golf club with such natural form and power was captivating. His miniature size juxtaposed with his perfect mechanics, turning his shoulders as he started his backswing, all the while not allowing his hips or body to slide to the right, looked like a fiction straight out of Hollywood. It was textbook form from a child too young to read. During the broadcast, Hill made a bold prediction. This young man is going to be to golf what Jimmy Connors and Chris Evert are to tennis. It's unclear what motivated Earl Woods to cold call Jim Hill. Was it an irrepressible urge to show off his talented child? An innocent impulse inspired by understandable parental pride? Or was Earl more calculating than that? In his 1998 memoir, Earl wrote that he hoped his son's fame would reach across the globe and lead him back to the war comrade who was responsible for Tiger's nickname. This was my fantasy, that this kid named after Tiger Fong would become famous one day, Earl wrote, and my old dear friend would read about a Tiger Woods in the newspaper or see him on television, and he would make the connection and find me. That statement was written just after Tiger had turned pro in 1996. Undoubtedly, there were other factors motivating Earl in 1978, but this much is clear. By age 2.5, Tiger Woods showed unmistakable signs of being a bona fide gifted child, and his father had set in motion a series of events that were more improbable and ultimately more burdensome than anything Charles Dickens dreamed up for his fictional child protagonist Pip in Great Expectations. Soon after Hill's profile on Tiger aired on KNXT, ABC daytime television talk show host Mike Douglas instructed his staff to book Tiger on his show. At the time, The Mike Douglas Show was one of the most watched daytime programs in America. It was filmed in Philadelphia and on October 6, 1978, with a live studio audience cheering him on. Tiger Woods scampered onto the stage wearing khaki shorts, white socks, a short-sleeved shirt with a red collar, and a red cap. His shoulders slumped forward under the weight of the miniature golf bag slung across his back. Flanked by Douglas, comedian Bob Hope, and actor Jimmy Stewart, Tiger put a ball on a tee, positioned himself, and hammered the ball into a net. Perfect! Douglas said as the audience cheered and Hope and Stewart clapped. But it was immediately clear that Tiger was uncomfortable. He tugged nervously at his left ear. How old are you, Tiger? Douglas asked. Tiger kept tugging at his ear while Earl answered for him. Sensing Tiger's discomfort, Douglas got down on one knee, put his hand on Tiger's shoulder, and said in a soft voice as he pointed at Bob Hope, Do you know who this man is right here? Tiger said nothing and continued tugging at his ear. What's the man's name? Earl said. Tiger looked away. Turn around and look at him, Tiger, Earl said. This man right here. It was getting awkward. Hope bent over, hands on his knees, and smiled at Tiger. What's his name? Earl repeated. Tiger finally looked up at Hope, but still said nothing. Eventually, Earl lifted him up. How about a putting contest with Mr. Hope? Douglas said. Can he putt too? Oh, yes, Earl said. Tiger placed his ball on the green about 5 feet from the cup and proceeded to miss the putt. He made 2 more attempts, both failures. Earl placed a 4th ball at Tiger's feet and took a step back. Tiger picked it up, moved it within a couple inches of the cup, and tapped it in. The audience erupted. Hope slapped his knee and howled. Douglas laughed so hard he dropped an entire basket of golf balls. It's easy to see this as a funny moment, but Tiger's appearance on the Mike Douglas show also revealed that he shared the textbook attributes of what child psychologists refer to as the gifted child. Quiet, sensitive, isolated. There was the incessant, nervous pulling at his ear, his obvious desire to please his father, and his need to succeed, evidenced by his determination to ensure that he didn't miss his final putt. In her landmark book, The Drama of the Gifted Child, renowned childhood researcher and psychologist Alice Miller defined gifted child as one who is more intelligent, more sensitive, and more emotionally aware than other children. Through decades of research, Miller concluded that the gifted child can be more attuned to his parents' expectations and will do whatever it takes to meet them, even if that means ignoring his own feelings and needs. Miller referred to a glass cellar as a place where a gifted child locks away his true self while trying to become his parents' ideal child. Actor Jimmy Stewart was no child psychologist, but he had been around show business for almost 60 years and had seen his fair share of little children who had been put onto the big stage by parents who failed to recognize or appreciate the long-term consequences of early stardom. After Tiger's appearance on the show, Stewart talked backstage with Earl. Then he commented to Mike Douglas, "I've seen too many precocious kids like this sweet little boy and too many starry-eyed parents." Tiger Woods' first appearance on national television was a seminal moment. It was not an overstatement to say that a star was born that day. It could also be said that a star was born prematurely. Not even some of the greatest athletes in the world, Muhammad Ali, Pele, Michael Jordan, Steffi Graf, Usain Bolt, had performed in front of a national audience at age 2. But for Tiger, appearing in front of the camera soon became the norm as Earl continued to generate media exposure for his son. Before long, Earl had Tiger on That's Incredible, an immensely popular reality show that featured everything from natural phenomena to high-risk stunts along the lines of juggling with knives or making a motorcycle jump over a rotating helicopter blade. At age 5, Tiger was the subject of a lengthy feature on the show, but it was Earl who did all the talking on camera. With Cultita at his side and a bunch of Tiger's trophies serving as a backdrop, Earl said, "We can't dictate to him what he can be and what he cannot be. So as a consequence, what we do is we participate with him in golf. And if it was bowling, we would participate with him in bowling," he added. "Each and every one has our own life to live. And he has the choice to live his life the way he wants to live his life." Cultita never spoke, but she gave her husband an icy glare when he pontificated about Tiger's having choices. Tiger did not have choices at that point. In fairness, no 5-year-old chooses how to live life. At that age, parents make the decisions. In the Woods home, Earl called the shots when it came to Tiger and his golf game. When Tiger was 4 years old, Earl decided it was time to get him a private instructor. He had set his sights on Hartwell Golf Course, a par-3 public course located just 7 miles from the house in nearby Long Beach. The problem was that Earl couldn't afford private lessons for Tiger. It fell to Cultita to figure out how to do it. Rudy Duran, a 31-year-old assistant pro, ran the junior program at Hartwell. Duran had wavy black hair, a mustache, and a trim, athletic build. He was working behind the counter in the pro shop one spring morning in 1980 when he noticed a woman with a 4-year-old in tow. "My son is very talented," she said. "My husband and I would be happy if you could give him some private lessons." Duran peered over the counter, and Tiger looked up at him. Duran had never seen a 4-year-old golfer. His initial reaction was quite similar to that of Jim Hill the first time Earl called him. Skeptical, but Duran didn't want to be insulting. "Well," he said politely, "let's check him out." Tiger followed his mother and Duran to the driving range. After Duran teed up 4 balls, Tiger pulled out the sawed-off wooden club that Earl had made for him. Using a 10-finger baseball grip, he swung, driving each ball roughly 50 yards with a perfect right-to-left ball flight. "Amazing," Duran thought to himself as he watched the balls in flight and studied Tiger's form. He couldn't get over the child's range of motion. He'd seen pros who couldn't swing like that. "I'd be happy to work with your son," he told Cultita. "He can play here anytime he wants." The going rate in those days for 30 minutes of private instruction for a junior golfer at Hartwell was about $15 an hour. But Duran didn't bring it up, and Cultita never asked. Convinced that Tiger was a prodigy, Duran was eager to help him develop without financial obligations or age restrictions. He would serve as Tiger's golf instructor for 6 years. During that time, he never billed Earl and Cultita, and they never offered to pay him. Tiger was instantly comfortable with Duran, who started by making him his own set of clubs. At that time, most junior clubs were like toys. But Duran used to work at a driving range where he had learned to regrip clubs and refinish woods, skills that came in handy when trying to outfit a 4-year-old. He took a set of lighter women's shafts to reduce the weight of the clubs, shortened them even more to fit Tiger's height, and then regripped them to fit his small hands. Duran's teaching approach boiled down to letting Tiger play. He already possessed a rhythmic swing and near-perfect balance. He also finished with his weight on his left foot, facing the target. It was unheard of to see such sound fundamentals in a child. So instead of drilling the youngster over and over, Duran simply allowed Tiger's natural abilities and his love of the game to grow organically. As a 4-year-old, Tiger would play 18 holes with Duran. He looked like a shrunken tour pro on the course, but off the course, he would talk to his teacher about eating a Happy Meal or about Star Wars. Rudy quickly became Tiger's best friend outside of his home. Parr at Hartwell was 54. Seeking to build Tiger's confidence, Duran created what he referred to as Tiger Parr, which was 67. For example, on a 140-yard par 3, Duran figured Tiger would hit his drive about 80 yards, leaving a full 7 or 9 iron onto the green. If Tiger hit the green and hold the putt, his 3 would equal a birdie, not a par. In less than a year, Tiger shattered Tiger Parr, shooting an 8-under 59. Duran felt Tiger was ready for his own custom-built irons. Earl agreed, and together they approached a sales rep from a company called Confidence Golf. Tiger's reputation was already spreading through golf circles in Southern California, and the Confidence rep wanted to be associated with the kid everyone was starting to talk about. He offered to outfit Tiger with a complimentary set of new clubs. Kindergarten was still months away, but Tiger was already starting to learn a valuable lesson. Superior athletes don't have to pay for things. Private lessons, greens fees, equipment. These expenses were part of the socioeconomics that normally limited the game of golf to kids from families that belonged to country clubs. Tiger was never going to be a country club kid, but that wasn't going to hold him back. Earl was always looking for ways to give his son an edge. Tiger was in grade school when his father furnished him with a cassette player and motivational self-help tapes. In addition to offering words of empowerment, the cassettes were filled with soft music and the sounds of nature, such as water flowing through a creek. In the early 80s, when other kids were listening to songs from Michael Jackson's Thriller on a Walkman, Tiger was filling his mind with words that were intended to make him great. He even wrote some of the messages from the self-help cassettes on a sheet of paper that he taped to his bedroom wall. "I believe in me. I will own my own destiny. I smile at obstacles. I am first in my resolve. I fulfill my resolutions powerfully. My strength is great. I stick to it, easily, naturally. My will moves mountains. I focus and give it my all. My decisions are strong. I do it with all my heart." Tiger listened to those tapes so often that he wore them out. They gave him a sense of confidence that enabled him to compete in the Optimist International Junior Golf Championship Tournament in San Diego as a 6-year-old. Out of 150 participants, Tiger finished 8th. All 7 boys who finished ahead of him were 10-year-olds. In 1984, at the age of 8, Tiger won the boy 9-10 division. A year later, he won again, finishing 14 strokes better than the boy who captured the age group above Woods. On the golf course, Tiger was so confident that he came across as cocky, strutting and celebrating after making putts. But in school, he was afraid to raise his hand. His anxiety was so severe that he developed a speech impediment. "My stuttering was so noticeable, and it made me feel so anxious," he would later write, "that I made sure to sit at the back of the classroom, hoping that my teachers wouldn't call on me." The only time he didn't stammer in school was when he talked about golf. Even his teachers noticed that in those instances he suddenly became confident and fluent. But when it came to any other subject, he recoiled. "My mind worked," Tiger explained, "but I couldn't get the words from my mind to my mouth. Anytime I had to speak, I stuttered so badly that I gave up." He spent 2 years in an after-school program designed to help him learn to speak more comfortably. Yet he continued to fight a stuttering problem all through grammar school. Golf was a double-edged sword for him. On one hand, his anxiety disappeared and his sense of self-confidence bloomed whenever he had a club in his hands. On the other, unlike team sports that facilitate interaction and communication with teammates, golf was a game that required Tiger to spend an inordinate amount of time alone. Even as he advanced through the grades of elementary school, he seldom had time to play with neighborhood kids after school. "I do remember putting in the garage for hours as I got older," Tiger recalled. "Pop had put down the worst-looking worn carpet on the floor, but it had what I would call lanes that were the same width as the head of a putter. I wanted to make sure that my putter moved away from the ball and inside the lane, then back to where I would hit the ball, and then moved inside and away from the lane again. Subconsciously, I learned that in the garage on the ratty piece of carpet," he continued. "The colors were almost blinding, yellow, green, and orange. It was putrid. My dad never used it, but I putted for hours on it." When he wasn't with his instructor or working on his game at the Navy course or putting in the garage, Tiger often retreated to his bedroom. There he had his inspirational tapes and a dog that his parents had brought for him. It was a Labrador retriever named Boom Boom. Alone in his room, Tiger would talk to him for hours. He never stuttered around Boom Boom. "He listened to me until I fell asleep," Tiger said. Chapter 4. The Prodigy. Sitting on the couch in his living room, 10-year-old Tiger Woods stared intently at the television, his mother seated beside him, his father a few feet away in his chair. It was Sunday afternoon, April 13th, 1986, and CBS was broadcasting the final round of the Masters. Earlier that day, as part of their father-son bonding, Tiger had played 9 holes with Earl at the Navy course near their home. But now he was watching 46-year-old Jack Nicklaus take the lead with a 3-foot birdie putt on the 16th hole that sent the gallery at Augusta into a frenzy. "There's no doubt about it," the announcer said. "The bear has come out of hibernation." Nicklaus went on to win the Masters for the 6th time that day, making him the oldest golfer ever to be awarded the green jacket and marking his 18th and final major championship. Tiger, at this point, had been counting his score in tournaments for about 7 years. He dreamed of playing at Augusta someday. Nicklaus's historic achievement formed the basis of Tiger's first significant Masters memory. His reactions over those last holes of the 1986 Masters made an impression on me because they were spontaneous, and they showed me how much of yourself you have to put into a shot, Woods wrote years later. "Jack was 46. And I was only 10, and I couldn't put it into words then, but I wanted to be where he was and doing what he was doing." Earl was a smoker, and when he was thinking, he liked to take a long drag on a cigarette and exhale slowly. There was a lot to think about as he watched his son watching the great Jack Nicklaus on television. The scene at Augusta National with the all-white gallery and Nicklaus's golden blonde hair was starkly different from the one in the Woods' living room. In 1934, the PGA of America amended its constitution to restrict its membership to professional golfers of the Caucasian race. Even though that clause had finally been expunged in 1961, country clubs like Augusta remained bastions of exclusivity for whites. It was the one aspect of golf that Earl despised. Throughout his life, he believed he had been denied personal and professional advancement based on the color of his skin. the pretty white girl he couldn't dance with at school, the motels in the Midwest that wouldn't give him a room when he traveled with his college baseball team, the racist colonel who blocked his advancement in the army. I was constantly fighting racism, discrimination, and lack of opportunities, Earl said. There was just no chance for an intelligent, articulate black person to do anything worthwhile or participate successfully in the process of life. It was frustrating and suffocating in so many ways, particularly for someone who wanted to achieve things but wasn't given the opportunity. Earl was determined that his son would change all that. Race wasn't going to hold him back. Tiger was going to do something worthwhile. He was going to get his opportunity. To hell with any notion of encouraging Tiger to be like Jack. Earl was grooming him to beat Jack. After the 1986 Masters, Golf Digest published a list of Nicklaus's career accomplishments. It included his age at the time of each significant achievement. Tiger tacked the list to his bedroom wall. From that moment on, each morning when he woke up and each night when he went to bed, Nicklaus was there. Tiger had been working with Rudy Duran for 6 years when Earl decided it was time for a change. Tiger was getting taller, and Earl wanted a coach who could shape his swing to his physical growth. He set his sights on John Anselmo, the head pro at Meadowlark Golf Course in Huntington Beach, about 13 miles south of Cypress. Anselmo had taught many child prodigies from California over the years. Earl went to see him shortly after the 1986 Masters and quizzed him on his philosophy and method of teaching. Anselmo had heard about Tiger, but it wasn't until he saw him swing that he realized he was one of a kind. "I'd never seen a child with that much ability," he said. He told Earl that the special ones required a different kind of coaching. "You don't do a lot of things," Anselmo told him. "You just do things natural, and you grow with that natural sense. You've got to have that feel sense." Earl knew enough to know that Anselmo was the best instructor in Southern California. They reached an understanding that was similar to the one Woods had with Duran. Anselmo didn't ask for payment, and Earl didn't offer it. The first time Anselmo worked with Tiger, he made some immediate observations. Tiger swung on a flat plane, meaning his left arm never rose above his shoulders during his backswing, and early in his swing, Tiger's right wrist hinged. No one had pointed these things out before. Tiger embraced Anselmo's technical approach and thrived on the new drills meant to help him improve. Carefully following instructions, he did things such as balancing on the balls of his feet and letting his arms hang down naturally. At the same time, instead of a club, he took hold of an empty driving range basket, grasping the left side with his left fingers and the right side with his right fingers. Then he swung back naturally, the basket pushing back from the target, stretching the muscles in his back and left arm. It was a new sensation, and the start of Tiger learning a bigger, fuller athletic motion. There was something else Anselmo noticed. Tiger was obsessed with hitting the ball far. This wasn't a technical flaw in his game, it was more of a mindset. It wasn't something that could be corrected through drills. Nevertheless, in Anselmo's view, this had to change. Swinging too hard could destroy a talented golfer. Tiger started meeting with Anselmo every week. Transportation to and from golf lessons and practice fell to Cultita. She also shuttled Tiger to all his tournaments. With Earl working full-time, Tiger spent most of his time with his mom. They went everywhere together. The summer before Anselmo entered the picture, Tiger went all the way to Thailand. It was an opportunity to see his mother's homeland and learn about her religion. He even went with her to meet with a Buddhist monk. Cultita handed the monk a chart she had been keeping since Tiger's birth, tracking all his achievements through the first 9 years of his life. She later recounted to a journalist what happened next. "The monk asked me when I was pregnant. Did I ask God for this boy to be born?" she recalled. "I asked why. He said because this kid is special, like God send an angel to be born. He said this Tiger is a special kid. The monk don't know about golf. Monks don't watch TV. Monk said it's like God send angel. He said Tiger is going to be a leader. If he go into army, he'd be a 4-star general. The visit to Thailand was a formative one in Tiger's relationship with his mother. He didn't feel compelled to practice Buddhism, but he was determined to please her. Each night before bed, Kaltita prayed to Buddha that in her next life, Tiger would again be her son. The head covers on his golf clubs had the Thai inscription Rakchak Mir, which meant love for Mom. You can always count on Mom, she assured him. Mom will never lie to you. They logged thousands of hours in the car together, traveling to lessons, practices, and tournaments all over Southern California. When Tiger competed, Kaltita walked every hole with him, carrying a scorecard and a pencil. She believed strongly in keeping score. Although pleasant and respectful toward Tiger's competitors, Kaltita didn't like to see anyone beat her son. While driving him to tournaments, she shared her philosophy with him. In sport, you have to go for the throat, she said, because if all friendly, they come back and beat your ass. So you kill them, take their heart. Off the course, Tiger knew the rules. 1. Education before golf. 2. Homework before practice. 3. No back talk. 4. Respect your parents. 5. Respect your elders. On the course, he had only one rule, play without mercy. It was an unusually hard-edged mentality on the junior golf circuit. But in 1987, at age 11, Tiger entered 33 junior golf tournaments and won every one of them. There's no feeling I've found that matches the feeling that I've beaten everybody, Tiger said. Second place is first loser. The evening hours were reserved for Earl. Most nights after Earl got off work, Tiger met him at the Navy course where they would play together until dark. Being alone on the course with Pop was his favorite thing to do. He considered that his peaceful time. On rare occasions, when Earl would arrange it, someone would join them for a round. One day when Tiger was 12 years old, they were joined by Eric Utgard, the commanding officer of a Navy destroyer. Back in 1969, Utgard was the first member of the Naval Academy to earn All-America status since the beginning of the Navy's golf program in 1909. He'd made arrangements to play around with Earl and Tiger. He also brought along a friend, Jay Brunza, PhD, a Navy captain who had worked with the Academy's golf team. What do you do for a living? Earl asked Brunza. Brunza explained that he was a psychologist who had been on the faculty at the Navy Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. More recently, he had been with the Pediatric Oncology Unit at Bethesda Naval Hospital, where he worked with children suffering from cancer and other life-threatening illnesses and diseases. When a child faced radiation treatment for leukemia, for example, Brunza would help him or her focus on alternative thoughts, something he called attentive awareness. He essentially used a form of hypnosis to help his patients visualize how to deal with discomfort. On a lighter note, Brunza was a very good golfer, and he had worked as a sports psychologist for the Navy's golf team. Utgard offered to play with Earl, and he suggested that Tiger be paired with Brunza in their foursome. Tiger immediately started talking trash to Brunza, who gave it right back to him. Tiger liked that, and he appreciated that Brunza could play. Throughout the round, Earl noted that there was an affinity between them. Afterward, he pulled Brunza aside. "Would you help me give Tiger the kind of advantage that a lot of country club kids get?" he asked. "Would you work with him?" Tiger had already spent over a year working with Anselmo to improve his balance. Brunza started driving up on weekends from San Diego to teach Tiger how to visualize shots. At the outset, he gave Tiger cassette tapes containing subliminal messages that were custom made for him. The two did breathing and visualization exercises together, in which Tiger learned to take a deep breath and hold it, and then exhale slowly while settling over a shot. It was a way of putting him at ease. Then Tiger changed his approach to putting. Instead of putting to the cup, he started visualizing a picture around the hole and putting to it. Brunza was using a blend of hypnotic techniques that he'd been using with cancer patients for years. "The hypnotic element is that absorption," Brunza explained. You think you lose control with hypnosis, but you don't. It's actually a heightened state of awareness and absorption. I taught Tiger a level of real focus technique, a creative awareness that you work into your nature. After each session, Brunza sent Tiger home with a list of things to work on. He never had to tell him to practice. Tiger was one of the best students ever, Brunza said, a very creative and gifted child. Like any kid, Tiger liked toys and games, but equipment fascinated him. The grips on clubs, the smooth, shiny surface of the shaft on a driver, even the smell and texture of the soft leather on a new golf bag. He took exceptional care of every item he owned, from his golf shoes to his golf balls to the covers on the heads of his clubs. Anselmo noticed this and decided to introduce Tiger to one of his former students, 25-year-old Scotty Cameron. When Cameron was a boy, he and his father started experimenting with putters in the family garage. At first, they were just tinkering, but soon the garage morphed into a workshop. When Cameron and his father weren't on the golf course, they were in the shop, wrapping grips, shaping club heads, and designing putters for what they referred to as field tests. It didn't take long for Cameron to realize that he wasn't going to make it as a pro and that his real gift was handcrafting putters. In his early 20s, he moved out of the garage and into a studio where he could produce elite clubs with state-of-the-art tools. Tiger was in awe when he saw Cameron's work. Despite being 13 years younger than Cameron, Tiger spoke his language. As for Cameron, the future, he felt, was in making putters that would end up in the hands of a golfer who would revolutionize the game. Tiger started using Cameron putters. At 12 years old, Tiger Woods was a boy surrounded by adults. He had the top golf coach in Southern California. He had a military-trained sports psychologist who often doubled as his caddy at junior tournaments. He had a true craftsman custom-making putters for him. His equipment, right down to his bag, was noticeably superior to that of other kids his age. And he had two parents, sometimes outfitted in Team Tiger t-shirts, whose lives were consumed with giving their son every advantage necessary to beat the wealthier country club kids he was up against. When he stepped onto the course at a junior tournament, the other kids were intimidated by him. Yet when Tiger looked in the mirror, he saw himself as small and scrawny. He was convinced that he wasn't tough enough, so he turned to his father for help. Earl put him through what he called Woods Finishing School, using psychological warfare and prisoner of war techniques that he had once taught to soldiers. Earl broke his son down in an attempt to toughen him up. The psychological training that my father used inured me to whatever I might have to deal with in golf, Tiger later said. He taught me to be completely aware of my surroundings while maintaining complete focus on the task at hand. Earl would later brag to golf writers that he would jingle the change in his pocket when Tiger was putting, or he would cough or drop his golf bag during Tiger's backswing. It was psychological warfare, Earl wrote in his memoir. I wanted to make sure he would never run into anybody who was tougher mentally than he was, and we achieved that. The stories, when told by Earl and others, sounded benign, just one more ingenious lesson passed from a father to a son. In reality, as Tiger would reveal long after his father's death, some of Earl's tactics, under today's standards, bordered on abuse. My dad deliberately used a lot of profanity when I was hitting balls all the time. And throughout my swing, Tiger said. Fuck off, Tiger, he would sometimes say. It was motherfucker this, you little piece of shit. Or, how do you feel being a little nigger? Things of that nature. He constantly put me down, Tiger recalled. Then, when I really got mad, he would say, I know you want to slam down that club, but don't you dare do it, don't you dare. He would push me to the breaking point, then back off. Push me to the breaking point, then back off. It was wild. We may never know how Tiger really felt at age 11, 12, or 13 as he was repeatedly called those demeaning names by his father. But in 2017, at age 41, Woods said this about the experience. I needed him to push me to the edge of not wanting to continue because I had to learn to block out any feeling of insecurity. We had a code word that I could use whenever I thought I couldn't take it anymore. But I never used the code word. I was never going to give in to what he was doing. I was a quitter if I used the code word. I don't quit. The code word that Tiger never uttered was enough. Earl's approach was a huge departure from anything Tiger had previously experienced. Rudy Duran and John Anselmo had always focused on building up his self-confidence, and Dr. Brunza was an extremely sensitive, mild-mannered teacher who didn't raise his voice. His whole approach was to put Tiger at ease. Earl, on the other hand, tried to make him feel insecure. At the time, no one but Tiger knew what Earl was up to. He had trained me to be what he sometimes called a cold-blooded assassin on the course by applying more of the principles he had learned and used while in the military, Tiger admitted in 2017. I needed this training if I was going to be able to deal with life as a professional golfer, with life as the supposed black hope in the game, and of whom big things were expected. I entered every tournament to win, and I expected to win. It was harsh, but it worked. Tiger simply overwhelmed the competition on the Southern California Junior Circuit. Even at the Leighton Invitational in Yorba Linda, California, an elite tournament that attracted the finest players in the region, he absolutely dominated. Tom Sargent, one of the most honored teaching professionals in Orange County, was the head pro at Yorba Linda Country Club. He knew nothing about Earl's methods, but he'd been watching Tiger for years and had gotten to know Cultita pretty well. They frequently spoke at tournaments, and Cultita would even call Sargent on occasion to compare notes afterward. Sargent felt that she had as much to do with Tiger's success as anyone. "Tita is a force," Sargent said, "and you really don't want to stand in her way. I say that in a positive way. Tiger was surrounded by toughness. Let me put it this way. You wouldn't dare fuck with her son. You'd get your ass kicked." Sargent had been hired as a private instructor for Bob May, an upperclassman at nearby Lakewood High School who was considered the top college prospect in Southern California. Two coaches in particular, Wally Goodman at Stanford and Dwayne Knight at UNLV, were pursuing May and would regularly check in with Sargent for updates on his progress. But Sargent had watched Tiger consistently dismantle older, bigger kids. At one point, Sargent told both Goodman and Knight that they should keep an eye on a 12-year-old named Tiger Woods. He was, in Sargent's estimation, a decade ahead of the other kids. In the spring of 1989, Tiger came home from middle school and found a letter from Wally Goodman addressed to him. The letter mentioned Tom Sargent and made clear that Stanford was interested in Tiger as a prospective member of the golf team. NCAA rules prohibited college coaches from contacting high school athletes between their freshman and junior years, but there were no rules forbidding coaches to write to middle school students, nor were there any regulations preventing a middle school kid from writing to a coach. On April 23, 1989, Tiger wrote back to Goodman. "Dear Coach Goodman, thank you for your recent letter expressing Stanford's interest in me as a future student and golfer. At first, it was hard for me to understand why a university like Stanford was interested in a 13-year-old seventh grader. But after talking with my father, I have come to better understand and appreciate the honor you have given me. I further appreciate Mr. Sargent's interest in my future development by recommending me to you. I became interested in Stanford's academics while watching the Olympics and Debbie Thomas. My goal is to obtain a quality business education. Your guidelines will be most helpful in preparing me for college life. My GPA this year is 3.86, and I plan to keep it there or higher when I enter high school. I am working on an exercise program to increase my strength. My April USGA handicap is 1, and I plan to play in SCPGA and maybe some AJGA tournaments this summer. My goal is to win the Junior Worlds in July for the 4th time and to become the first player to win each age bracket. Ultimately, I would like to be a PGA professional. Next February, I plan to go to Thailand to play in the Thai Open as an amateur. I've heard a lot about your golf course, and I would like to play it with my dad sometime in the future. Hope to hear from you soon. Sincerely, Tiger Woods, 5'5", 100 pounds. Privately, Goodman suspected that Tiger hadn't written the letter on his own. There are other verifiable instances when Earl told Tiger what to say in his letters, and this letter in particular appears to have been dictated by Earl. It was too polished and calculated for a 13-year-old, but Goodman didn't care. He was so pleased that he shared Tiger's letter with his team and bragged about how well it was crafted. The way he looked at it, Stanford had gotten a leg up on all the other colleges that would eventually be recruiting this kid. The summer of 1989 marked a turning point for Tiger and his family. Although he was only 13, everyone agreed that he was ready to start competing in national junior golf tournaments. This prompted a change in parental roles. Earl retired from his job at McDonnell Douglas, which enabled him to go on the road with Tiger. Meanwhile, Cultita would remain at home to take care of the house and the dogs. Tiger's first event was the Big One National Championship, the nation's largest junior golf tournament. He would be up against all the top junior golfers in the country, Justin Leonard, David Duvall, Nota Begay III, Chris Edgman, Patrick Lee, and many others. In all, there were 155 participants. Tiger was the youngest. The tournament was held at the Texarkana Country Club in Arkansas, and tournament officials had placed the junior golfers in private housing for the weekend, but Earl made it clear that he wanted no part of that. He didn't want his son to stay with other people. Tiger, he told the tournament chair in a phone call, would be staying in a hotel away from everyone else. He wanted to keep his son focused. On the first day of the tournament, Tiger looked like a child among teenagers, but he shot a 71 and cruised to a three-way tie for first place. He easily made the cut, and on the third day when the juniors were paired with PGA Tour pros, he found himself playing with 23-year-old John Daly, a rough-and-tumble young gun known for being the longest hitter on the tour. As soon as the round started, Daly began blasting balls over trees with his driver and hitting sand wedges to par fives. Woods resisted the temptation to show off his power, instead remembering to follow Anselmo's advice about not overswinging. After 9 holes, he led Daly by 2 strokes. Determined not to get embarrassed by a 13-year-old, Daly buckled down on the back 9. Still, with 3 holes to play, Tiger was in position to beat or tie him. It wasn't until Tiger bogeyed 2 of his last 3 holes that he finally ended up losing the round to Daly by 2 strokes. But he finished 2nd overall in the tournament, making him the youngest player to ever finish in the top 5. The fact that Tiger had nearly beaten Daly was the talk of the tournament, and it triggered speculation about when he might turn pro. Tiger remained mum. Earl, on the other hand, went out of his way to tell reporters that Tiger was free to be whatever he wanted to be. "If he wants to be the head fireman in Memphis, Tennessee, that's fine with me," Earl told one journalist. "There are no expectations or inherent pressure on him to become a pro." That fall at Orange View Junior High, Tiger was undoubtedly the most gifted athlete in the school. Yet he didn't play football, basketball, soccer, or baseball, at least not officially. In junior high, he did it secretly, one of his closest friends recalled. He wouldn't tell his dad. Tiger couldn't join other sports teams, but he couldn't resist competing on the playground. In one instance, he was playing football during recess when he fell and scraped his knee while leaping to catch a pass. He made a big deal out of what appeared to be a relatively minor abrasion. "Aw, man," he said, inspecting his knee. "Don't worry," one of his friends said. "It's not that bad." "You don't understand," Tiger told him. "My dad is going to kill me. I'm not supposed to be playing football on a playground." Chapter 5. Who is Tiger Woods? Tiger entered Western High School in Anaheim in the fall of 1990. At 14, he stood 5'9", weighed 120 pounds, and could drive a golf ball almost 300 yards off the tee. Only a handful of pros hit the ball farther. He was the top junior player in Southern California, and every major college with a top-ranked golf program was eyeing him. Golf writers were already opining on when he would turn pro. Western High's golf coach, Don Crosby, felt like his fledgling golf team had won the lottery when Tiger arrived. But school officials had no idea that incoming freshman Eldrick Woods was being touted as the future of golf. Months before school started, the district was considering a modest boundary change that would have put Tiger's home just outside the Western High district. In an urgent meeting with Western High's principal, Crosby unfurled a map and drew a circle around the parcel of land at the corner of Teakwood and Chestnut Streets in Cypress. Whatever you do this summer, Crosby told the principal, don't lose that tract. Why? The principal asked. Because a kid named Tiger Woods lives there. The principal looked up from the map and stared blankly at Crosby. Who is Tiger Woods? Students didn't know Tiger either. His circle of friends was limited to three guys, Alfredo Arguello, Mike Gout, and Byron Bell. Tiger had known Arguello the longest. They'd met in second grade and been friends ever since. They even played on the same youth soccer team. But in all that time, Arguello had seen the inside of Tiger's house only once. Gout was a year older than Tiger and lived a few doors down from him. And then there was Bell, a kid known as a brain. Tiger had met him in junior high. He also played golf and would become the second best player on Western High's team. By the time they got to school, Woods, Arguello, and Bell were like the three musketeers. All of them were in AP and honors classes together. Arguello was a top student in the freshman class. Woods and Bell were right behind him. They were nerds in every sense of the word, competing against each other for the best grades. They knew they weren't part of the popular crowd, which consisted of jocks and cheerleaders, but they had already figured out where they were headed in life. Alfredo, Woods would say, you're going to be my attorney, and I'm going to be your doctor, Bell would chime in. Outside of school, Tiger had one more friend, 24-year-old Joe Groman, the assistant pro at the Navy course. They had met in 1989, shortly after Groman started working there. In the summer leading up to his freshman year at Western High, Tiger often averaged more than 10 hours per day on the practice range. Groman was also there every day, and he started looking after Tiger like an older brother. It intrigued him that Tiger was far more inclined to practice than to play a round of golf. One afternoon, he finally brought it up. "Why don't you play the course more?" Groman asked. "I like practicing better," Tiger told him. It would not be an exaggeration to say that Tiger spent more than 500 hours practicing during the summer months before his freshman year, not including the hundreds of additional hours he spent participating in tournaments. Extreme practice habits were neither new nor challenging for him. "The first thing I taught Tiger, aside from the love of the game of golf, was the love of practice," Earl said. "When he was real small, people would ask him, 'How did you get so good, Tiger?' And he would answer, 'Practice, practice, practice.'" Practicing golf was never a chore or something Tiger felt obligated to do. He looked forward to being alone on the range or the course with his clubs. They were, in a sense, an extension of his creative genius. In his book, Outliers, Malcolm Gladwell looked at the careers of gifted geniuses, Bill Gates, Mozart, Bobby Fischer, the Beatles, and concluded that preparation habits played a bigger role in their extraordinary achievements than innate ability did. Using Gates and the Beatles as test cases, Gladwell looked at how much time they had spent practicing and preparing in their youth. Gates, for example, logged more than 1,500 hours on a mainframe computer during a 7-month span in 8th grade, and averaged 20 to 30 hours a week teaching himself to program. Similarly, Paul McCartney and John Lennon started playing together in high school a full 7 years before they made it big and performed live together an estimated 1,200 times before the Beatles played their first concert in America. Gladwell coined the phrase the 10,000-hour rule to explain the effort that separated the greats from everyone else. The people at the very top don't work just harder or even much harder than everyone else, Gladwell wrote. They work much, much harder. Tiger started working on his craft much earlier than Gates or McCartney or Lennon. When he was 6 months old, barely old enough to sit up, he spent countless hours strapped in a high chair watching his father practice his swing. By the time he was 2, according to Earl, Tiger was spending 2 hours per day hitting golf balls. At that rate, Tiger would have reached 10,000 hours by age 15. But by age 5, he was spending far more than 2 hours per day practicing golf. By that point, he was performing on television and playing in tournaments. It's probably a conservative estimate that Tiger Woods had already spent more than 3,000 hours playing and practicing golf by the time he appeared on That's Incredible at age 5. To put this in perspective, It's estimated that McCartney and Lennon achieved 10,000 hours of practice by the time they were 20. Bill Gates hit the 10,000 mark around the time he turned 21. Tiger Woods had probably accumulated 10,000 hours playing and studying golf by the time he was 12. Right before the start of Tiger's freshman year in high school, Groman nicknamed him Champ. It never quite caught on, but Groman always referred to him that way, and Tiger liked it. He also appreciated some straightforward advice that Groman gave him about girls. Avoid them. Golf required an inordinate amount of time, and a girlfriend was nothing more than a distraction. The woods are full of guys who were phenomenal until they met a girl, Groman told him. Tiger wasn't worried. No girls were paying attention to him anyway. They were interested in football players. They were the guys who got the girls, not him. Girls at school didn't even know Tiger's name. Early on in high school, Woods was interviewed by a reporter for People magazine who asked him if it was hard missing out on so many childhood experiences, specifically the fact that Tiger didn't have a girlfriend. I couldn't fit her in, Tiger said, adding, this is better than childhood. This was playing golf. Tiger was about a month into his freshman year when Earl received a phone call from Jamie Diaz, a senior writer for Golf Digest. Diaz expressed an interest in meeting Tiger and perhaps profiling him for the magazine. Earl suggested they start by playing a round of golf together. Diaz agreed to fly to L.A. Meeting a journalist wasn't Tiger's idea of fun. He had never been particularly keen on talking to strangers who carried pens, notepads, and handheld recorders. His dad had been arranging interviews for him since he was 2 years old, and by 14 he was sick and tired of it. But on a Saturday morning in the fall of 1990, he dutifully went with Earl to Coto de Casa Golf and Racquet Club, a private course in Orange County, to meet Diaz. Looking down at his feet, Tiger mumbled hello when Diaz introduced himself. Diaz didn't bother trying to make small talk. They went straight to the first tee and started playing. After a few holes, Tiger started warming up to Diaz. He seemed different from other journalists. For one thing, most golf writers were white, and Diaz was a pleasant exception. He could also play, always a plus in Tiger's book. After the round, Tiger and Earl joined Diaz for a meal at Sizzler. Conversation quickly turned to the media. So, who are the assholes? Tiger blurted out in between bites. Pretty cynical for a 14-year-old, Diaz thought, but he kept it to himself. I think you have to figure everybody out yourself, he told Tiger. I find some guys difficult to deal with, another guy finds him to be a favorite. Tiger nodded. So I just say, have an open mind and don't go in like everybody's trying to screw you, Diaz continued. Earl chimed in that he had taught Tiger to answer only the question that is asked and never to elaborate. It was clear that Tiger possessed a fairly sophisticated understanding of the media and how it worked. He knew all the golf writers by name, and he was well-read. Diaz was invited to the house to meet Cultita. By the time he left town, he was on a first-name basis with everyone. It was the start of a unique relationship that promised to benefit both him and the Woods family. Tiger grew up about 40 miles from the ultra-exclusive Bel Air Country Club in West Los Angeles, but he'd never been there before the spring day in 1991 when he arrived to watch Jack Nicklaus put on a clinic. The club was impressive. It was impossible not to admire its lush green fairways and crystal-clear swimming pools. Club members included Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, Bing Crosby, Jack Nicholson, and Clint Eastwood. Only recently had the first black golfer been admitted to the membership. At one point, Nicklaus called on Tiger to demonstrate his swing. As a 15-year-old being ballyhooed as golf's great black hope, Tiger felt the eyes of everyone at the clinic shift from Nicklaus to him. It was a feeling he had experienced many times previously when entering country clubs. Privately, he referred to it as the look, which he compared to the feeling of walking into a prison with everybody staring at him. On this occasion, the feeling was even more pronounced. Weeks earlier, African-American taxi driver Rodney King had been savagely beaten by four white police officers after a high-speed chase that ended nearby in the San Fernando Valley. Amateur video showed taser wire on King's body as he was down on the ground being clubbed with batons, stomped, and kicked in the head and neck. The chilling video led to the arrest of all four officers and triggered a national conversation on police brutality and race in America. Remaining poised, Woods demonstrated his flawless swing.